Welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, bringing the tales and stories of the ancient Celts to your fireside.
Episode 17A, Spring Holiday Show, Part 1.
Hello, welcome to the Celtic Myth Pod Show. I'm Ruth.
And I'm Gary. We've got a lot for you in this spring holiday special, so we'll nip straight into the contact details and get on with the show.
Yes, pop along to our website at CelticMythPodShow.com and check out the Contact Us page under Other Show Stuff. You'll also find out how to talk to us on MySpace, Facebook and Twitter, and as many other ways as we can find.
Oh, yes. And we keep finding them.
We do.
I've also managed to set up this Skype answering machine, which is really cool. Add Celtic Myth Pod Show, which is all one word, to your contacts and drop us a message. If we're around, we might be able to talk to you as well.
Yeah, that's fab. Thank you for setting that up. It means we can talk to people. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And a couple of people have already left us some personal messages.
Yeah,
and
they're lovely.
They are. They're always nice. Let's crack on with some news and views, shall we?
Yes, I've got some news. I have.
Right, what you got?
Did you know that Cornish as a nationality is being excluded from the 2011 census?
Now, I did hear something about that. So what's going on there?
Well, in case anybody doesn't know, over here in the UK, we have a count-up of everybody that's living in the country called a census, and it takes place every 10 years.
That's right.
Well, both our Labour and Conservative MPs voted to keep the Cornish nationality out of the census.
What's that about, then?
I don't know, but come on, you political people, sort it out. Cornish is one of the Celtic nationalities, for goodness sake.
That's true.
Honestly.
That's true. Okay, so shall we start with some music?
Yes, well, coming from Yule and the winter season, try and think of reindeer and the icy plains of Siberia.
Okay, got it.
Now listen to the Magic Folk with their track, Shaman Spirit Reindeer of Siberia.
Sky, a visit to another world inside. Shaman.
That was a stirring piece of New Age shamanic goodness written and performed by one of our listeners, Ben, from Magic Folk. We believe this track to be from their forthcoming second album of the same name. Check out the website for news.
So shall we have some details about springtime, a very important time for the Celts?
No.
Okay then.
Let's have something completely different.
Right, okay. Okay, so how about Fairy Faith in Wales by W.Y. Evans-Wentz, written in 1911?
That's a good idea, especially as we're about to enter the Welsh myths.
Yes, this is one of my favourite books. I've had this one for years and years.
I'm still catching up on it.
And it's a fabulous book, so I'm looking forward to reading from it.
Okay. The Fairy Faith in Wales by W.Y. Evans-Wentz. Less can be said of Wales than of Ireland, or of Scotland as a whole. It has, it's true, its own peculiar psychic atmosphere. Different, no doubt, because its people are Brythonic Celts, rather than Gaelic Celts. But Wales, with conditions more modernised than is the case in Ireland or in the Western Hebrides of Scotland, does not now exhibit in a vigorous or flourishing state those Celtic influences, which when they were active, did so much to create the precious romances of Arthur and his brotherhood, and to lay the foundations for the Welsh belief in the Tylwyth Teg, a fairy race still surviving in a few favoured localities.
Wales, like all Celtic countries, is a land of long sea coasts, though there seems to be, save in the mountains of the north, less of mist and darkness and cloud effects than in Ireland and Scotland. In the south, perhaps the most curious influences are to be felt at St David's Head, and in St David's itself, once a goal for thousands of pilgrims from many countries of medieval Europe, and probably, in pagan times, the seat of an oracle. And a place of like character is the peninsula of Gower, south of Swansea, Caerphilly Castle, where the Green Lady reigns now amid its ruined acres. It's a strange place, and so is the hill near Carmarthen, where Merlin is asleep in a cave with the fairy woman Vivian. But in none of these places today is there a strong living faith in fairies, as there is, for example, in West Ireland. The one region where I found a real Celtic atmosphere, and it is a region where everybody speaks Welsh, is the mountainous country rarely visited by travellers, save archaeologists, a few miles from Newport. And its centre is the Pentre Evan Cromlech, the finest cromlech in Wales, if not Britain. By this prehistoric monument, and in the country round the old Nevin Church, 3 miles away, there is an active belief in the fair folk, in ghosts, in death warnings, in death candles and phantom funerals, and in witchcraft and black magic. Thence on to Newcastle Emlyn and its valley, where many of the Mabinogion stories took form, or at least where they drew rich material in the way of folklore, are environments purely Welsh, and as yet little disturbed by the commercial materialism of the age.
There remains now to be mentioned 3 other places in Wales, to me very impressive psychically. These are ancient Harlech, so famous in recorded Welsh fairy romance, Harlech with its strange stone circles, an old castle from which the Snowdon Range is seen to loom majestically and clear, and with its sun-kissed bay. Mount Snowdon, with its memories of Arthur and Welsh heroes, and sacred Anglesey, or Mona, strewn with tumuli and dolmens and pillar stones. Mona, where the druids made their last stand against the Roman eagles, and its little island called Holyhead, facing Ireland. However, when all is said, modern Wales is poorer in its fairy atmosphere than modern Ireland or modern Brittany. Certainly there is a good deal of this fairy atmosphere yet, though it's become less vital than the similar fairy atmosphere in the great centres of Erin and Armorica. But the purely social environment under which the fairy faith of Wales survives is a potent force which promises to preserve underneath the surface of Welsh national life, where the commercialism of the age has compelled it to retire in a state of temporary latency, the ancestral idealism of the ancient Brythonic race. In Wales, as in Lower Brittany, and in parts of Ireland and the Hebrides, one may still hear in common daily usage a language which has been continuously spoken since unknown centuries before the rise of the Roman Empire.
And the stronghold which the Druidic Eisteddfod, an annual national congress of bards and literati, continues to have upon the Welsh people, in spite of their commercialism, is again a sign that their hearts remain uncorrupted, that when the more favourable hour strikes, they will sweep aside the deadening influences which now hold them in spiritual bondage and become as they were in the past, the true children of Arthur.
That was fascinating. I'm looking forward to finding out more about the other Celtic nations and their relationships to the Sidhe.
Yes, it'll be interesting to find out, won't it?
Yeah.
Something else I wanted to ask, I don't know, is, even though I've read Evans Wentz, Armorica, do you think that's American? Is that American?
No, I think that's an area of Brittany.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we'll put some research into it and find out for you in the show notes, but I think it's part of Brittany.
Yes, it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Sure. Sure.
Anyway, let's move on.
And have a piece of music.
Yes, so let's have a piece of music by the amazing harpist Phil Holland, as she brings us another Sidhe-inspired piece of music, Lough Sidhe. She tells us that Lough Sidhe means warrior fairy and is based on the battles of the Tuatha De Dananann. Oh, Beautiful. Beautiful.
Wonderful. And you can find that and other beautiful tracks on her album, Fairies. Details can be found in the show notes.
Now, don't keep us in suspense any longer. What's the story we've got today?
Well, this is an 18th century Scots tale by the famed author John Mackay Wilson, called The Wife or the Wuddy.
Uh-oh, here comes my bad Scotch accent.
The Wife or the Wuddy by John Mackay Wilson.
There was a criminal in a cart, a-going to be hanged. Reprieve to him was granted. The crowd and cart did stand to see if he would marry a wife or otherwise choose to die.
Oh, why should I torment my life?
The victim did reply.
The bargain's bad in every part, but a wife's the worst. Drive on the cart.
Honest Sir John Falstaff talks of minions of the moon. And truth to tell, 200 or 300 years ago, nowhere was such an order of knighthood more prevalent than upon the borders. Not only did the Scottish and the English borderers make their forays across the Tweed and the Ideal Line, but rival chieftains, though of the same nation, considered themselves at liberty to make inroads upon the property of each other. The laws of meum and tuum they were unable to comprehend. Theirs was the strong man's world, and with them, might was right. But to proceed with our story. About the beginning of the 17th century, one of the boldest knights upon the borders was William Scott, the young Laird of Harden. His favourite residence was Oakwood Tower, a place of great strength, situated on the banks of the Ettrick. The motto of his family was Reparabit Cornua Fabi, which, being interpreted by his countrymen in their vernacular idiom, ran thus,
We'll hae moonlight again.
Now the young laird was one who considered it his chief honour to give effect to both the spirit and the letter of his family motto. Permitting us again to refer to Honest Falstaff, it implied that they were gentlemen of the night, and he was not one who would loll upon his pillow when his avocation called him to the foray. It was drawing towards midnight in the month of October, when the leaves in the forest had become brown and yellow, and with a hard sound rustled upon each other, that the young Scot called together his retainers, and addressing them said,
Look ye, friends, is it not a crying sin and a national shame to see things going aglee as they are going? There seems hardly such a thing as manhood left upon the borders. A bit of scratch with a pen on parchment is becoming of more effect than a stroke with a sword. A baron now stands as good a chance to hold and to have as an armed man that has a hand to take and to defend. Ugh, such a state of things was only made for those who are o'er lazy to ride by night, and o'er cowardly to fight. And never shall it be said that I, William Scott of Harden, was one who either submitted or conformed to it. Give me the good old manly lore that they shall keep who can, and with me honest sword will I maintain my right against every enemy. No, there is a natural and lawful adversary, old Sir Gideon Murray O'Ellibank, and he carries his head as high as though he were the first cousin to a king, or the sole lord of Ettrick Forest. More than once has he slighted me in a way which it was not for a Scot to bear. And weel do I ken that he has the will, and wants but the power to harry us a house and hay. But by my troth, he shall pay a dear reckoning for all the insults he has offered to the Scots of Harden. Now every Murray among them has a weel stocked mailing, and their kine are weel favoured. And tonight the moon is laughing cannily through the clouds. And therefore, what say ye, neighbours? Will ye ride with me to Ellibank? And before morning, every man of them shall have a tomb by her.
Well, I am from the young man. He's a true Scot from head to heel.
Ride on, we'll follow ye.
But I am.
The moon glints over the hills and it guides us to the spoils of Ellibank. Tonight we shall bring the Lang Syne back again.
There were 20 of them. Stout and bold men, mounted upon light and active horses. Some armed with firelocks, others with jeddak staves, while in addition to such weapons, every man had a good sword by his side. At their head was the fearless young laird, and at a brisk pace they set off towards Ellibank. Mothers and maidens ran to their cottage doors, and they looked after them with foreboding hearts when they rode along, for it was a saying amongst them that
When young Willie Scott of Harden set his foot in the stirrup at night, there were to be swords drawn by morning.
They knew also the feud between him and the House of Ellibank, and as well did they know that the Murrays were a resolute and a sturdy race. Morn had not dawned when they arrived at the scene where their booty lay. Not a Murray was abroad. And to the extreme they carried the threat of the young laird into execution of making tomb buyers. By scores and by hundreds they collected together into one immense herd, horned cattle and sheep, and they drove them before them through the forest towards Oakwood Tower. The laird, in order to repel any rescue that might be attempted, brought up the rear, and in the joy of his heart he sang, and at times he cried aloud,
"There will be dry breakfast in Ellibank before the sun gets out, but a merry meal at Oakwood afore he gangs down. An entire bullock shall be roasted, and wives and bairns shall eat of it."
"I humbly beg your pardon, Maister William,"
said an old retainer named Simon Scott, who traced a distant relationship to the family.
"I respectfully ask your pardon, but I've been in your father's family for 40 years and never was backward in the hour of danger or in a ploy like this. But you will just allow me to observe, sir, that wilful waste makes woeful want. It seemed the occasion, whatever, for roasting a bullock, must be as bad as our neighbours on the other side of the Tweed. We were roasting or baking in the oven, and every day of the week, and making a stain weight of meat no gang so far as 2 or 3 pounds we'd a doon. And therefore, sir, if you take my advice, if we were to hae a feast, there'll be nae roasting in the way." "Oh, it was a fine sharp frost the other night, and I observed the rime lying on the kale, so that baith greens and savoys will be as tender as a weel-boiled 3-month-old chicken. And I say, therefore, let the beef be boiled. Let them hae ladles full of kale, and you'll find, sir, that instead of hale bullock, that even if you intend to feast old and young, male and female, on the lands of Oakwood, a quarter of a bullock will be ample sufficient. And the rest can be sauteed down for winter's provisions. Ye ken, sir, that the Murrays winna let us lichtly slip for this night's work. And it's aye safest, as the saying is, to lay by for a sair fate."
"Well argued, good Simon. But your economy is ill-timed. After a night's work such as this,
There is surely some license for Gilbert Avishan.
I say, you dare contradict me. Tonight there is not one belonging to the House of Harden, be they old or young, who shall not eat of roast meat and drink of the best.
Well, sir, your reverence be it spoken, but I would beg to say that you're wrong. Folk that ants get a liking for dainties, they take ill with plain affare again. Moreover, sir, in all my experience, I never ken dainty bits and hardihood go hand in hand. On the contrary, luxuries make men effeminate and discontented into the bargain.
The altercation between the old retainer and his young master ran farther, but it was suddenly interrupted by the deep-mouthed baying of a sleuth-hound, and its threatening howls were followed by a loud cry, as if from 50 voices of...
Tonight, Professor Gideon and the House of Yellowbank!
But here we pause to say that Sir Gideon Murray of Yellowbank was a man whose name was a sound of terror to all who were his enemies. As a foe, he was fierce, resolute, unforgiving. He had never been known to turn his back upon a foe or forgive an injury. He knew the meaning of justice in its severest sense, but not of compassion. He was a stranger to the attribute of mercy, and the life of the man who had injured him he regarded as little as the life of the worm which he might tread beneath his heel upon his path. He was a man of middle age, and he had 3 daughters, none of whom were what the world calls beautiful, but on the contrary they were what even the dependents upon his estates described as very ordinary-looking young women. But stealthily, as the young master of Harden has made his preparations for the foray, old Sir Gideon had got timely notice of it, and hence it was that not a Murray seemed to stir when they took the cattle from the byres, and they drove them towards Oakwood. But through the moonlight, there were eyes beheld every step they took. Their every movement was watched and traced, and amongst those who watched was the stern old knight, with 50 followers at his back.
Quiet! Quiet!
He again and again in deep murmurs uttered to his dependents, throwing back his hand, speaking in a deep and earnest whisper that awed even the slow but ferocious sleuth-hound that accompanied them, and caused it to crouch back to its feet. In a yet deeper whisper, he added encouragingly,
"Patience, my merry man. Bide your time. You shall he work before long go by."
And when, therefore, the young laird and his followers began to disperse in the thickest of the forest, as they drove the cattle before them, Sir Gideon suddenly exclaimed,
"Now for the onset."
And at the sound of his voice, the sleuth-hound howled loud and savagely,
"We are followed! Halt! Halt! To arms! To arms!"
cried the heir of Harden. 3 or 4 were left in charge of the now somewhat scattered herd of cattle, and to drive them to a distance, while the rest of the party spurred back their horses as rapidly as the tangled pass in the forest would permit, to the spot from whence the voice of their young leader proceeded. They arrived speedily, but they arrived too late. In a moment, and with no signal save the baying of the hound, old Sir Gideon and his armed company had burst upon young Scott and old Simon, and ere the former could cry for assistance, they'd surrounded them.
"Willie Scott, ye rash laddie, you quietly, or a thief's death shall ye die. And in the very forest through which ye have this night driven my cattle, the Corbies and you shall become acquaint, or at least if ye see not them, they shall see you and feel ye too."
"Brag on, ye old greybeard. But while a Scot of Harden has a finger to wag, no power on earth shall make his tongue say I am conquered. So come on, do your best, do your worst. Here is the hand and the sword to meet ye, and were ye 10 to 1, you should find that Willie Scott isn't the lad to turn his back. No 10 full-grown Murrays stand before his face."
By my sooth, then, fellow Callan, and it was small mercy after what ye had done that I intended to show ye. And after what ye have said, it should be less than I'll grant ye. See, come on, lads, now to humble the Harridans.
Arm! Every Scot to arms! And now, Sir Gideon, he'll measure your weapons and leave your weal fair daughters as a legacy to the world. Be it say. But they are lads among your clan of whom they would have been glad, and who belike in pity might have offered them to their hands, but who will this night mak of the bride of your greensward? Come on, Sir Gideon, and on you and yours be the consequence.
Before sunrise, and the winsome Laird Harden shall boast less vauntingly, and rue that he had broken his jeers upon an old man. Touch me, sir, but know me, bairns.
The conflict began, and on each side the strife was bloody and desperate. Bold men grasped each other by the throat, and they held their swords to each other's breasts, scowling upon one another with the ferocity of contending tigers, ere each gave the deadly plunge which was to hurl both into eternity. The report of firearms, the clash of swords, the clang of shields with the neighing of maddened horses, the lowing of affrighted cattle, the howl of the sleuthhounds and the angry voices of fierce men mingled wildly together, and in one fearful and discordant echo rang through the forest. This wild sound was followed by the low, melancholy groans of the dying. But as I've already stated, the Scot and the cattle which they drove before them were scattered, and ere those who were in advance could arrive to rescue their friends in the rear, the latter were slain, wounded, or overpowered. They also fought against fearful odds. The young laird himself had his sword broken in his grasp. He was instantly surrounded and made prisoner by the Murrays, and at the same time, old Simon fell into their hands. The few remaining retainers of the House of Harden gave way when they found their leader a captive, and they fled, leaving the cattle behind them. Sir Gideon Murray, therefore, recovered all that had been taken from him, and though he had captured but two prisoners, the one was the chief, and the other his principal adviser and second in command. The old knight, therefore, commanded that they should be bound with cords together, and in such rueful plight, led to his castle at Elibank. It was noon before they reached it, and Lady Murray came forth to welcome her husband and congratulate him upon his success. But when she beheld the heir of Harden the captive, and thought of how little mercy was to be expected from Sir Gideon when once aroused, she remembered that she was a mother, and that one of her children might one day be situated, as their prisoner then was. The young laird, with his aged kinsman and dependent, were thrust into a dark room, and he who locked them up informed them that the next day their bodies would be hung on the nearest tree.
On my long life and long fasting, you surely wouldn't be speaking of such a thing as hanging to an old man like me. You'd be whether be shot or beheaded, though I'd like neither the aim nor the other. It wouldn't be a thing in particular to be a complaint of. But to be hanged like a dog is so disgraceful and unchristian-like. I'd rather die 10 times in a day than feel a hempen cravat about my neck, Hans. And moreover, I must say that hanging is not treating my dear young maister and kinsman as he ought to be treated. His birth, his rank, the memory of his ancestors and mine, that they demand mere respect. And therefore I say, go tell your maester that if he's determined that we are to die, that though I have no ambition to cut my breath before my time, that I think as a gentleman it's his duty to see that we die the death of gentlemen.
Silence, Simon. Let Murray hang us in his bedchamber if he will. No matter what manner of death we die, provided only that we die like men. But let him hang us if he dare, and the disgrace be his that is coward enough to him so to make an end of his enemy.
Oh, sir, that's poor comfort to a man that has to leave a small family behind him.
Simon, are you afraid to die?
No, Your Honour. Well, that is, I'm no more afraid to die than other men are, or ought to be, but only you'll observe, sir, that I have no ambition. Not, as I may say, to draw my last breath upon a wedding. but to have it very unnaturally stopped. Begging your pardon, but you're a young man. Well, I have a wife and a family that'll be left to mourn for me. Oh, sir, the wife and the bits of bairns, they press uncasarily upon a man's heart when death tries to come in the way between him and them. In exploits like that in which we were last night engaged, and also in battles abroad, I faced danger in every shape 100 times, and yet, sir, to be shot in a moment, as it were, or to be run through the body and to die honourably on the field, is a very different thing from deliberately walking up a ladder to the branch of a tree, from which we're never to come down in life again. And more than that, if we'd have been a Johnny Farr's gang, they couldn't have yet treated us more disrespectfully than condemn us to the death in the way that they've decreed for us.
Provided you die bravely, Simon. It's little matter what manner of death you die. And as for your wife and weans, fear not. The father's house will provide for them. For the wife full now, there'll be other heirs left to the estate of Harden. And while the prisoners thus conversed in the place of their confinement, Lady Murray spoke unto her husband, saying,
"And what, Sir Gideon, if it be a fair question, may ye intend to do with the broy young Laird of Harden, now that he is in your power?"
He drew her gently by the arm towards the window, and pointing towards a tree which grew at a distance of a few yards, he said,
"You see yonder branch o' the elm tree that is waving in the wind? Tomorrow, Scott and his kinsmen shall swing there together, who hereafter say that I am no Murray."
"Oh, good man, it is because I was terrified that you'd be doing the like of that. That is what caused me to ask the question. Now I must say, Sir Gideon, that whatever ye may think, ye are not only acting cruelly, but foolishly."
I care nothing about the cruelty. What mercy did I or Scott e'er show to me or mine? Lady Murray, the bowl is at my foot, and I will kick it, though I deprive Scott of Harden o' a head. And what mean ye, dame, by saying I act foolishly?"
"Only this, good man, that ye have 3 daughters to marry, whom the world does not consider to be all well fared, and it isn't every day that ye have a husband for ain them in your hand."
"Sooth, and for once in your life you're right, good wife. There's more wisdom in that remark than I would have gi' you credit for. Tomorrow, the Burgie of Harden shall hae his choice, either upon the instant to marry a daughter, Micklemouth Meg, or strap for it."
"Well, Sir Gideon, to make him marry my Meg would be mair purpose-like than to cut off his head and the hope of the old house in the very flowery youth. There is nae doubt to the choice he will make, for there is an unco difference between them."
"Dinna be o' sure. There is nae saying what his choice may be. There's both pluck and a spirit of contradiction in the callan. I wouldna be in the least surprised if he preferred the wordy. I ken, had I been in his place, that what my choice would have been."
"I dare say, Sir Gideon,"
replied the old lady, who was jocose at the idea of seeing one of her daughters wed.
"I dare say I could guess what the choice would have been."
And what in your wisdom do you think he would have been? The wife or the wordy?"
"Oh, Gideon, Gideon, well do you ken that your choice would have been the wife?"
"Nay, you're wrong. I'd rather die of death that was before me than marry a wife I'd never seen. But go ye. Prepare Meg for becoming a bride the morn, and I shall see what the intended bridegroom says to the proposal."
In obedience to his commands, she went to an apartment in which their eldest daughter Agnes, but commonly called Micklemouth Meg, there sat, twirling a distaff. The old dame sat down by her daughter's side, and after a few observations respecting the weather, and the quality of the lint that she was then torturing into threads, she said,
"Well, I'm thinking, Meggie, that you make me an old woman. You'd be 26 at past Lammas."
"So I believe, mother,"
said Meggie, and a sigh, for a very deep and long-drawn breath, followed her words.
"Dear me, young men mourn me growing very scarce. I wanted 4 months and 5 days of being 19 when I was married to your father, and I had refused at least 6 offers before I took him."
"Aye, mother, but you had a well-fared face, a And there lay the difference. Hee-ho.
Hee-ho,
responded her mother in pleasant raillery.
What is the lassie hee-hooing at? Certes, if you get a good man before you're 26, you may think yourself a very fortunate woman.
Yes, but I see small prospect of that. I doubt you'll see the Ettrick running through the Dowry Dells of Yarrow before ye hear or tell of an offer being made to me.
Did I say, Baron? There is nae saying what may betide ye yet. Ye think ye winna be married before you're a 26? But truly, my dear, there has mony mair unlikely ship come to land. Now what would ye think of the young Laura of Herden?
Mother, mother, wherefore ye mock me? I never saw ye do that before. My father has taken William Scott for prisoner, and from what I have heard, he will hang him in the morning. You ken what a man my father is. When he says a thing, that he will do it. And how can you jest about the young man when his very existence is reduced to a matter of minutes and moments? Though rather than my father should take his life, if I could save him, he should take mine.
Well said, my bairn, but dinna ye put about it concerning what will never come to pass. I doubt na that before morning you find your Scatter Harden at your feet, begging you to save his life by giving him your hand and troth and becoming his wife. Then ye ken your father couldn't have for shame hang or do any harm to his own son-in-law.
Oh, mother, mother, it never be in my power to save him. For what he has said, you'll never think of. And even if I were his wife, I question if my father would pardon him, though I should beg it upon my knees.
Ray father's no sail as that, Meggie Madu. Mark my words, if Willie Scott content to marry you, you'll henceforth find him and your father hand in glove.
While this conversation between Lady Murray and her daughter took place, Sir Gideon entered the room where his prisoners were confined, and addressing the young laird, said,
"Know your rank, marauder. Though death is the very least that ye deserve, or I can expect from my hands, yet I will give ye a chance of your life. And ye shall choose between a wife and the widdie. Tomorrow morning ye shall either marry my daughter Meg, or swing from the branch or the nearest tree, and the boldest Scot upon the borders shall attack ye down, until ye drop away bone by bone a fleshless skeleton."
"Good save us, most honourable and good Sir Gideon,"
suddenly interrupted Simon, in a tone which bespoke his horror.
"But you certainly didn't intend to make an anatomy of me, too. For surely when my honoured master marries Miss Murray, as I hope and trust he will, that you will allow me to dance at their wedding, instead of dancing in the air and keeping the time to the music of the same wind. And oh, master, for the sake of your own sake, and especially out of regard to my small and helpless family, consent to marry the lassie. Though she is no extraordinary well-fowled, for I'm sure that rather than die a dog's death swinging from a tree, that I would marry 20 wives, though they were as old as the hills, as ugly as a starless midnight, and had tongues like trumpets."
"Peace, Simon. If ye had turned coward, keep the sound of your fears within your own teeth. And ye, Sir Gideon, in your amazing mercy and generosity, ye'd spare my life upon the condition I should marry your bonnie daughter Meg. Look ye, sir, I am Scott of Harden, and ye are Murray of Elibank. There's no love lost between us. Chance has placed my life in your hands. Take it, for I would not marry your daughter though you should give me life and the lands of Elibank into the bargain. I fear as little to meet death as I do to tell to your teeth that had ye fallen into my hands, I would have hung ye with as little ceremony as I bring a whip across the back of your disobedient hound. And therefore, ye are welcome to do the same to me. Ye are taking what ye thought to be a sure mode of getting a husband for any of your winsome daughters. But in the present instance, it has proved the wrong one, old man. Do ye worst, and there will be Scots and who left to avenge the death of the Laird of the Harden."
"There, then, is my thumb, young braggart, that I winna hinder ye in your choice. For tomorrow ye should be exalted as Hammond was, and let those revenge your death who dare."
"Maester, dear maester,"
cried Simon, wringing his hands,
"will ye sacrifice me also, and break the hearts of my pure wife and family? Oh, sir, accept Sigirian's proposal. Marry his daughter.
Silence, your milk-lilied slave. You pretend to bear the name of Scott, and yet tremble like an ash leaf at the thought of death.
Oh, you will excuse me, sir, but I tremble at no such thing. Only as I've already remarked, I have no particular ambition of being honoured with the exaltation of the halter, and moreover, I see no cause why a man should die unnecessarily, or where death can be avoided. Sir Gideon, humble prisoner as I at this moment am, and in your power, I leave it to you. If you ever saw anything in my conduct in the field of battle, and you have seen me there, that could justify anyone in calling me either milk-liver or a coward, I consider it to be altogether unjustifiable to deprive me of a life, which is always precious, merely because my maester is stubborn and will marry your daughter. Oh, sir, I'm not a very old man yet, and if you'll set me at liberty, though I'm now a married man, in the event of my ever becoming a widower, I give you my solemn promise I will marry any of your daughters that you please.
Audacious idiot!
Exclaimed the old knight, raising his hand and striking poor Simon to the ground.
Sir Gideon Murray, are you such a base knave as to strike a fettered prisoner? A shame for ye, man. Where's the pride of the Murrays now?
Sir Gideon evidently felt the rebuke, and withdrawing from the apartment, said as he departed,
Remember, but when the sundial shall tomorrow note the hour of 12, so surely shall ye be brought forth, and the wife shall be your lot, or the woody your doom.
Leave me, and the gallows be it. My choice is made. Till my last hour, trouble me not again.
Sir, I beg. I pray that you will alter your determination. There's surely nothing so awful in the idea of marriage, even though your wife should have a face not particularly well favoured. You dinna ken, sir, but that the young woman's looks are at worst fault. Indeed, I heard her spoken of as a lass of your great sense and discretion, as having an excellent temper. Oh, sir, if you kenned as well what it is to be married as I do, you'd think that a good temper was a recommendation far before beauty.
Hold thy fool's tongue, Simon. Would you disgrace the family with which you've made it your boast to be connected, when in the power and presence of its enemies? Do as you see me do. Die and defy them.
It was drawing towards midnight when the prison door was opened, and the sentinel who stood watch over it admitted a female dressed as a domestic.
What want ye? Or whom seek ye, maiden?
I come to speak with the Laird of Harden, and to ask if he has any dying commands that a poor lassie could fulfil for him.
Dying commands? Oh, are those no awful words? Can you still be foolhardy enough to say you want to marry?
Who sent ye, maiden? Or who are ye?
A despised lassie, sir. An attendant upon Sir Gideon's lady, in whom ye have had a true and steadfast friend. Though I doubt that, as ye have refused poor Meg, her intercession will avail ye little.
And wherefore has Lady Murray sent ye here?
Just, sir, because she is a mother, and has a mother's heart. As ye hae a mother and sisters who now be mourning ye at Oakwood, she thought that belike ye would hae something to say, that ye would wish to hae communicate to them. And if ye be say, I'm come to offer to be your messenger.
Oh, maiden, speak not of my poor mother, or you'll unman me. I would wish to die as becomes my father's son.
That's right, Henny. Speak to him about his mother again. Talk a bit of sorrow, poor lady, and her tears, and her distraction and mourning. And I hae little doubt but we shall get him to marry Meg, or do anything else, and I shall get back to my family after all.
What is it you whisper, Simon, in the maiden's ear?
Oh, nothing, sir. Nothing, I assure ye. As any saying that if ye send her o'er to Oakwood with a message to your poor honoured wretched mother, that she would inquire from my poor widow, Janet, and me bits of bairns, and that she'd tell them that nothing troubled me upon my deathbed. No, not my deathbed, but I declare I'm ashamed to think of it. I was saying that I was simply telling her to inform my wife and bairns that nothing distracted me in the hour of death but the thought of being parted from them.
Without noticing the evasive reply of his dependent and fellow prisoner,
The laird, addressing the intruder, said,
You speak as a kind and considerate lassie. I would like to send a scrape of a pen to me poor Metheron. If you'll be its bearer, she will reward you.
And belike, you would like to hear if the good lady has an answer back, or to learn how she bore her tidings of your unhappy fate.
Before you could return, the time appointed by my adversary for my execution will be past, and I shall feel for my mother's sorrows with the sympathy of a disembodied spirit.
But if you would like to hear from your poor mother, or be like to see her, for there may be a family matters that you would wish to have arranged, I think through the influence of my lady, Sir Gideon could be prevailed upon to grant you a respite for 3 or 4 days, and as he isn't a man that keeps his passion long, perhaps by that time he may be disposed to save your life upon terms that would be more acceptable.
No, maiden. He is my enemy. And from him I wish no terms, no clemency. Let him fulfil his purpose. I will die. But my death shall be revenged. Tell my mother that it was my latest injunction that she should command every follower of our house to avenge her son's death, while there is a Murray left in all of Scotland to repent the deed of the Knight of Elibank.
Oh, sweet young ma'am, oh, mistress, bear the lady no such message, but rather, as ye said, try if it be possible to get your own good lady to persuade Sir Gideon to spare our lives for a few days. And as ye say, the edge of the old knight's revenge may be blunted by that time, or perhaps my worthy young maester might be brought to see things in a clearer light, and perhaps to marry Miss Margaret, by which means our lives may be spared. For it's certainly the height of madness in him to sacrifice my life and his own, rather than marry her before he's sinner.
Simon! Simon!
The maiden has spoken kindly. Let her endeavour to procure our respite. A reprieve for you! In your death my enemy can have no gratification. But for me, leave me to my cell.
Oh, sir, you wrong me. You mistake my meaning altogether. If you're to die, I die also. But do you not think it would be as valorous, or may rational at least, to see and hear of the young lady before you determine to die rather than to marry her?
And hae ye preferred the gallows to poor Meg without even seeing her?
If I hae na seen her, I hae heard of her, and by all accounts her countenance is nain that any man would desire to see accompanying him through the world like a shadow at his oxter.
She's been represented worse to you than she looks like. If you saw her, you might change your opinion. And perhaps, after all, that she isn't a bonny. Is that all anyone can say against her?
Hish, lassie. I winna be forced to anything. A Scot may be led, but he winna drive. I ain't nae wish to see the face of your young mistress, for I winna hae you. But you speak as one that has a feeling heart. And before I trust ye with me last letter to me poor mother, I should like to have a glance at your face, and by your countenance I should judge whether or not it'll be safe to trust ye.
She threw back the hood that covered her head.
I doubt, sir, you will see as little in my features as you expect to find in my young mistress's to recommend me. But, sir, you ought to remember the jewels are often encrusted in coarser metals, and you'll often find a delicious kernel within the unsightly shell.
You speak sweetly, and sensibly as sweet,
said he, raising the flickering lamp which burned before them upon a small table, and gazing upon her countenance.
And I'll now tell you, lassie, that if your features be not beautiful, there is honesty and kindliness written upon every line of them, and though you are a dependent in the house of my enemy, I will trust you. Try if I can obtain the writing materials to address a few lines to me, mother, and I will confide in you to deliver them.
You may confide in me, and the writing materials which you desire, I have brought with me. Write, and not only shall your letter be faithfully delivered, but as you have confided in me, I will venture to say that your life shall be spared until you receive her answer. For I might say that what I request, Lady Murray will try to see performed. And if I can find any means in my power by which you can escape, it shall not long be that you shall remain a prisoner.
Oh, thank you. Doubly thank you. You're a good and a kind creature. And though my maester refuses to marry your mistress yet, had I been single, I would have married you. But, oh, On you go with a letter to his mother, my honoured lady. Will you just go away down a little bit, White House, which lies by the riverside, about a mile and a half aboon Selkirk, and there you'll find my poor wife and bairns, or rather I should say my unhappy widow and my orphans. Will you tell them, tell my wife that I never kenned how dear she was to me till now, and that if she marries again, my ghost will haunt her night and day. And tell her also that, and tell also the bairns that, above everything, I charge them to be good to their mother.
The young laird sat down, and writing a letter to his mother, entrusted it to the hands of the stranger girl. He raised her hand to his lips as she withdrew, and a tear trickled down his cheeks as he thanked her.
Well, that was the end of the first part of our story. You can hear the second part in our second half of the spring holiday special, which will be coming out shortly.
Yes, when the secret is revealed. And what will brave Willie do? And can anyone put up with Simon's whinging any longer?
We'll have to wait and see how the plans of the Maiden of the Peace turn out.
Ah, yeah. Great stuff. Really atmospheric of an earlier time. And do you know what I was thinking while we were recording that?
No.
Isn't it funny that by the 17th, 18th century, the Celtic tradition of cattle raiding was still taking place?
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it?
Isn't it? Some things never die.
I must apologise for my really bad Scottish accent. So anybody Scottish who's listening, please, please forgive me.
Yeah, more practice, the better we'll all get.
Anyway.
Let's move on, shall we?
Let's do that.
Yeah, let's have some amazing atmospheric Irish music before we have our listener feedback.
Yes, let's have a listen to Dark Patrick and Riddles.
There was a lady in the west, led the band to the bonny broom. She had three daughters, all the best. There came a stranger to the gate, led the band to the bonny broom, and he 3 days and nights did wait. The eldest daughter did open the door, led the band to the bonny broom, the second set him on the floor. Daughter, she brought a chair, laid the band to the bonny broom, and placed it that he might sit there. Now answer me this question's nine, lay the band to the bonny broom, or you shall surely all be mine. Bonny broom, to you with us our answers bring.
Paul and Ava, that make up Dark Patrick, bring us an amazing blend of Irish and Ukrainian music. You can find this track on their album of the same name.
More details in the show notes?
More details in the show notes. Do you know that's going to become a catchphrase for us?
Maybe. We should finish off with some listener feedback.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Do you remember that beautiful story we heard back in Beltane, 2009, almost a year ago now, called Nummies Trees by Keith Wilson?
Yes, it was beautiful, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Hi, Ruth and Gary. This is Keith Wilson. Just leaving you a message. Thought I'd try this phone thing out. Just wanted to say I was surprised and delighted today. Didn't realize there was a new episode up, and I was listening to it, and it's a lovely surprise to hear that you had done my story. So I wanted to say thanks for all the great work you're doing, and keep it up, and we'll be in touch, I'm sure. Take care.
That really is beautiful. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you so much, Keith. It was lovely. And we're so glad that you enjoyed the performance. And until the second half of our show, we'd both like to say...
Slongavoil. Did you know that the Cornish as a nationality has been excluded from the what?
Ignore the date, because 23,011... Who knows what's going to be in the census? I think I might have got that wrong. Hey, this is a sci-fi show now, did you realise?
Yeah, it was just...
So you did it perfectly. I'm speaking out of my backside. Nothing new there. The maiden has spoken kindly. Let her endeavour to procure a respite. Let her pray for you, boy. In your death, my enemy can have no gratification.
Scots might be better.
Oh, sorry. Okay, right.
You've been listening to the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com. We hope you've enjoyed the show and will stay tuned for the next episode. You can send us a quick email or voice feedback by emailing either Gary, that's G-A-R-Y, or Ruth, R-U-T-H, at CelticMythPodShow.com. You can chat to us in the forums on our website. The show notes for this episode can also be found on the website. We'd like to say a special thank you to Coulan's Hound, provided us with a theme music for our show. You heard Haghole at the beginning and are listening to The Skylark now. You can find out more about this foot-stomping band at www.sfhounds.com. And thanks again to Diane Arkinstone and Kim Robertson, whose music has been used for some of the incidental music in this podcast. You'll find links to their websites in our show notes.